My name is Sandy Svetkov. With me, my partner, Susan Alexander. We're with the Coghlan Stoyo Law Firm in San Francisco. We represent the pension funds who come before the court in a consolidated appeal seeking reversal of both of the major principal rulings below. First, the district court denied class certification, and second, it granted summary judgment on the principal Section 10B and Section 11 claims. The district court ruled on class certification solely on the issue of loss causation, and it held that the plaintiffs failed, or it believed that the plaintiffs failed to prove loss causation by a preponderance of the evidence. And then, even though this court granted a 23F appeal, the district court then entered a second order holding that its ruling on at class certification on loss causation was dispositive on the merits of the Section 10B claims. Now, the latter ruling is clear error on this, under this court's Bell, Unger, and Oscar cases. Class certification rulings are not supposed to be dispositive. They're not supposed to bind the trier of fact at trial or the summary judgment judge. But we've fully covered that in the briefs, and we may get to that this afternoon, but it colors the earlier ruling, because the earlier ruling goes to the whole concept of loss causation within class certification. What is the proper standard for dealing with loss causation at class certification? That's the principal question. The district court applied what we've characterized as a pair of fact-for-fact tests. We suggested a test that derived from Dura, applied in Oscar, which we say is the truth plus relatedness.
Well, she said she didn't, so... She said she didn't, and she said she disavowed that in an earlier ruling. So wherein do we hone in?
Okay. Well, in the earlier ruling, she, Judge Boyle, ruled in denying the defendant's motion for 1292B appeal of her denial of the motion to dismiss. Judge Boyle ruled that in pleading loss causation, to demand fact for fact revelation or admission of every category of misstatement alleged was excessive, and it was inconsistent with the idea of candor in our securities laws. It really, what it did was allow the defendants to immunize themselves simply by withholding disclosure of one or more of the parts of the falsity. Now, our submission is, the relevant economic consequences, when they are revealed, and we think the reduced earnings guidance in 2002 in July and in September of 2002, pulling down the 2002 forecasts twice by a substantial amount, resulting in a 37% and a 38% decline in the stock prices over a two-month period, a total of about 60% of the stock price was taken out. We say that that is the relevant truth. That is the economic consequence of the fraud alleged. Now our burden is to show how that related to the fraud. How did that disclosure relate to the fraud? Because the defendants are right. Nothing was said about debt covenants in that disclosure. Nothing was said about false historical results. Nothing was said about increased costs. To the contrary, they continue to lie about that. They continue to conceal that the integration problems were hurting the company. They continue to lie about their compliance with the debt covenants. They repeated that lie on September 27th. And so what the disclosures were partial disclosures. But under Dura, partial disclosures, leakage, should be sufficient. And that's where we part company with the defendants in the district court. It was an all-or-nothing approach by the district court and the defendants. Every falsehood, every category of falsehood has to be revealed in the disclosure. It's trial by revelation. We don't get a trial anymore. Now we look only at the corrective disclosures, and if that doesn't cover every part of the fraud, we're done. Well, if that's the rule, the only securities case that will ever be brought is where there is that kind of complete admission of fraud. Now, I recognize that the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act raised the bar, but it didn't raise the bar to say only confession cases could be brought as securities cases. That's not what the PSLRA said. So we think that the Dura-based standard, the Dura says the relevant truth
is... Would you state the test in as simple a fashion as you can?
Yes.
As you think it should be?
Yes. Dura defined a corrective disclosure as the point in time when the facts as to the finances of the corporation which had been previously misrepresented become generally known. That's the language of Justice Breyer, which all members of the court joined in. Now, Your Honor, I went back and I looked at the transcript of the oral argument in the Supreme Court in Dura, and I found something very interesting, and I'd like to share it with you and with counsel. At oral argument, when the government, as amicus curiae on behalf of the corporation, was arguing, Justice O'Connor, you asked a series of questions. And the second one was, where do you part company with the corporation in this case? And it was a very illuminating answer by the Solicitor General. Inflation attributable to the misrepresentation or omission has to be removed or reduced from the price of the stock through the dissemination of corrective information of some sort. That does not mean the company must make an announcement or that there must be an admission of fraud. We agree with the government. It's the first time this law firm has agreed with the government on anything in a very, very long time. But the government has it exactly right. That is the correct interpretation of Dura. That was in the Dura decision, and that should guide this court's decision in this case. Now, that is not to say that we're not in compliance with OSCAR. OSCAR and Greenberg and Judge Wiener and Judge Stewart and I were all on the Crosswords case. Judge Davis is not with us, but I'm sure you remember that the concept of relatedness meant that when there was a disclosure, there had to be evidence in the record, not in the disclosure itself necessarily, but somewhere in the record to relate what was disclosed to the fraud. We have that in this record. First of all, if you recall from the briefs, I recited a series of press releases by the company in which it said that its earnings results and its earnings forecasts were dependent on the savings of costs from the integration of the two companies that they had acquired. And they kept saying that if we save on those costs, we're going to have greater earnings, and if we don't, we're going to have more. And the press releases go both ways. So the company itself put those issues together. Judge Boyle disregarded that evidence. Then what about the debt covenants? Well, on September 26, well, first of all, the debt covenants themselves say that they're based on earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. So debt covenants and earnings fit together. They're related. So if your earnings guidance goes down, there's concern about debt covenants. In fact, many of the analysts did express concern about debt covenants. But what happened? The disclosures, as I said earlier, were half-truths. They disclosed the reduced earnings, but they kept lying about the debt covenants. Well, there's a case in this circuit that punishes people who engage in half-truths. It's called Plotkin. Plotkin was written by Chief Judge Jones, and she makes the point that half-truths are sometimes worse than outright lies because they put out the little bit of the truth but conceal a large part of what's still false. And what was false in this case? 2 years later, they finally got around to restating. And even then, they couldn't get it right. They had to wait another 2 years to 2006. They finally restated $60 million of earnings. And earnings were crucial to this company. Now, you know, all of this sounds complicated. We have to have statements from the company. We have internal documents that say, look, this company's accounting controls were in such a shambles, they couldn't forecast. That shows not only scienter, but it also shows a relationship between the accounting and the historical results and the forecasts. So there's lots of evidence in this record of relatedness. So we've got the relevant economic consequences being disclosed and the relatedness to the fraud. That proves loss causation, and it proves it by a preponderance of the evidence under the appropriate standard. Now, the defendants and their experts and Judge Boyle go into this fact-for-fact approach. Under the fact-for-fact approach, they either have to have a direct disclosure of each part of the fraud or sufficient facts for the market to subjectively recognize all parts of the fraud. Well, the market is not the trier of fact. The market is not interested in whether it's fraud or not. It might be if they knew it. What they're interested in knowing is what are the economic consequences. Once they know the economic consequences, it's up to us in court to prove a fraud. We don't have to prove it in the marketplace, but that's what the upshot of Judge Boyle's decision is, and that's what the upshot of the defendant's position is.
Let me ask you something at that point. If this court were to adopt, instead of the fact for fact, the true financial conditions test, what would be the result in your case as the way Judge Boyle applied it or we should on appeal?
Well, the result in our case would be that we pled and proved a single scheme to defraud in which all four of these categories of false statements that the Judge Boyle treated as separate pieces of a pie are all one pie. We related them in the complaint and we related them in the record.
Well, how would the market get wind of something being rotten?
They would. When you pull your earnings down by 25% twice in 2 months, after telling the market for 9 months repeatedly that you're going to have a great 2002, that the integration synergies have turned around and are being realized, and that even the quick ship business, which had been hurt by 9/11, was turning around. When you say all those things to the market and then pull the rug out from under them, they know something is rotten in Denmark.
Well, they may know something's wrong, but do they know something's rotten?
Well, yes, I think so. When the stock price goes down 37%, Judge Wiener, and then 38%, somebody thinks something is rotten. That's a huge drop in the stock price. And in fact, if you recall, one of the analysts said, the market seems to think something is fundamentally wrong with the core business, or it's some sort of reduced expectations. We think it's the latter. Well, the analysts were misled. The market got it right. The market understood it. Understood not all parts of the fraud, but understood the economic consequences of the fraud. And then it's up to us to prove it in court. Now, I thought you were going to ask me, Judge Wiener, if we have a true financial condition test, then plaintiffs would win in every case. There would never be a case where we couldn't win. Well, I want to say to you, Your Honor, that doesn't work. Look, Oscar was a case where there were four disclosures, but only one related to the fraud. Okay, so the problem for the plaintiffs in Oscar was they were unable to link the fraud they alleged to the disclosure that was made. They never made that linkage. We make it here. That doesn't mean it gets made in every case, not to mention the fact that in every case we have to prove scienter. We have to get past a huge hurdle at the motion to dismiss stage.
Not for certification, though, do you?
Not for certification, we have to show market efficiency. We have to meet all the Rule 23 factors. This is just a piece of the pie. This is predominance. Quite frankly, the Fifth Circuit has the toughest standard on class certification because Oscar, unlike every other circuit, demands loss causation be proven at class certification. All other circuits only require market efficiency, not class certification. And yet we meet that heroic standard. You know, Judge Dennis has been strongly disagreed with the Oscar and Greenberg decisions in your court. And he may be onto something. I'm not suggesting that you need to go on bank because we meet your higher standard in this case, Judge Wiener. That's our principal submission. And this fact-for-fact test is the true windfall in this case. If you adopt that test, then you give the defendants the ability to immunize themselves from except if they admit something. And if they can artfully word their disclosures, and here's an example of it. They say to the the earnings missed because our quick ship business, our market related factors, industry hurt the business. Well, there's something very interesting in this record, and I went back over it because the defendant's expert, Ms. Allen, discovered that all of the other peer companies had suffered greater earnings loss than Flowserv. And she put that in the record. Judge Boyle, at page 29 of her order, got it wrong. She thought that Flowserv's stock price had dropped less than the other peer companies. But she was referring to a part of Ms. Allen's report that dealt with earnings. And so I'd like to share that with you because I don't think that's been the focus of our briefing. And if you look at page 29 of the district court's order, she says that, you know, what's the problem? Flowserv didn't suffer as much as the peers. Flowserv stock price didn't go down as much as the peers. And she cites page 43 of the report. But page 43 of the report doesn't deal with stock price. It deals with earnings. So what do you deduce from that? If the peers had greater earnings deficit as a result of those market factors than Flowserv, and yet Flowserv stock price went down much further, then something else must explain it.
Let me ask you a question before you run out of time. The class certification question of predominance is separate from the merits question, I think, of loss certification.
Of class
loss causation.
Well, is it? Not the way the Fifth Circuit does it.
Well, I just wondered whether the trial court couldn't tackle the merits question while we're reviewing the class certification question.
Well,
are they all linked together?
But what she did instead, Justice O'Connor, was enter an order saying that her decision on loss causation at class certification was dispositive of the merits. Well, how could it be? She ruled that she found by a preponderance of the evidence that loss causation had not been shown. But for summary judgment, the standard is not whether the judge found a preponderance of the evidence, but whether a jury could find on that evidence by a preponderance of the evidence. And that's part of our submission in the briefs, that what the judge did was take the Rule 23 standard and gut the Rule 56 standard. And that's something that affects the plaintiff's right to due process, which Judge Higginbotham and Oscar said was due to plaintiffs as well as defendants. Well, if we can't get to a jury and we can't get to summary judgment because the judge has made a merits determination at loss causation, that is a denial of due process. And I think the red light is on for me, so I'd better
sit down. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Noel Hensley. I represent Flowserv Corporation, and I'll be speaking for 17 minutes on behalf of all the defendants. I will address the district court's loss causation analysis and focus on the standard that the district court used, which was correct, and the district court's proper application of that standard to the evidence in the record. Mr. Wilder, who represents PricewaterhouseCoopers, will speak for 3 minutes, and he will focus on Section 11 issues and the alternative statute of limitations defense argument. We are talking about loss causation here, and here on the district court's order, it means the lack of evidence to support loss causation means that under Oscar, a class cannot be certified. It means that the plaintiffs cannot prove an element of their 10B claim and that the defendants have proven the negative causation defense for the Section 11 claims. Starting with the issue of the loss causation standards, we share one common piece of ground, and that is under Dura, and Fifth Circuit case law, no loss, no proximate loss is caused by a misstatement unless the truth is later revealed to the market, and the revelation of that truth causes a decline in the stock price. What the parties dispute is what is meant by revelation of the truth. Judge Wiener, you asked, well, how does the market know that something is rotten, not just wrong? And the answer was the stock price went down. That is not the test. It makes sense to step back against this dispute and remember that what we're trying to determine is whether the alleged false statement is the proximate cause of the stock decline. For that to happen, the case law teaches us that the truth of the facts that had been allegedly misstated needs to be revealed to the market. It is the revelation of the truth that provides the nexus for loss causation purposes between the prior alleged misstatement and the stock price decline. Under the standard applied by the district court, the truth is revealed to the market when the market learns information showing that the prior alleged statement was false. That standard is correct under Dura and this court's opinions. The plaintiffs say the revelation of the truth means something completely different and that the district court erred primarily for not following their standard. This is their true financial condition plus relatedness standard. Under their standard, the disclosure that reveals the truth is any negative news that reveals that the company's financial condition is worse than previously thought. It never requires that the plaintiff change its belief in the truth of the prior alleged misstatement, a critical failing for loss causation. Their theory equates negative information with revelation of the truth. Even though negative information on its own doesn't show proximate causation, it's just new information. It may or may not have any relationship to the prior alleged misstatement of a proximate sort. New information, as Dura recognizes, just adds to the tangle of information that is before the market. Unless the later news shows falsity of the prior alleged misstatement, then that prior alleged misstatement is still believed by the market. It still thinks it's correct, and it's still incorporated in the stock price. Now, adding this notion that it must be related to doesn't mean anything with respect to whether or not it changed the market's belief in the truth of what the plaintiffs say was allegedly false. So their theory simply eliminates the requirement that the market learn that a prior alleged misstatement was false. It is inconsistent with the fraud on the market theory that they sue on. At the front end of a fraud on the market case, the plaintiffs claim that the market heard and reacted to information that it didn't know was actually false, and that the market thereby incorporated the false information into the stock price. That's why the market needs to learn the information on the back end that shows it was false, so it can assess that information and correct the stock if it chooses to do so. And that's
now,
why
if we assume for a minute that the initial representations made here were false and fraudulent, is there any question that they caused loss to the plaintiffs?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. And Dura makes that very distinction, because even if the stock price was inflated on the front end because there was a misrepresentation, it is by no means a logical proximate leap to say that when negative news comes out, the market then understood that. In other words, the loss isn't because of the misstatement. The loss for proximate purposes, consistent with Dura, comes when the market learns that it was false, not just that something that's negative that affects the company occurred. Oscar says there must be evidence that links the culpable disclosure, the prior allegedly false statement, to the stock price movement. The negative news only does that if it reveals falsity. If the falsity is not revealed, the inflation still is in. That was the lesson of Dura.
Now connect that to preponderance.
Preponderance of the evidence is the rule in Oscar that takes the basic three elements for a fraud on the market presumption and puts with it the notion that loss causation must be part of it, and that in doing so, a court faced with the class certification motion must be entitled to resolve conflicting evidence to weigh evidence. That's where the preponderance comes from. It is not correct to say that this district judge who applied predominance under Oscar to the class certification motion then used the same standard when she was considering summary judgment motion. She did not. It's evident on the face of her rulings that she didn't. What she did do was to look at the quantum and quality of the evidence to determine whether there was any evidence that would support a finding of loss causation.
Well,
under
it's a peculiar rule, though, that the district court applied because it rewards the defendants for failing to come clean. It's an odd rule.
Your Honor,
I don't understand it.
Loss causation recognizes that
it says if you don't reveal what you've done, you're safe. So don't ever tell the truth here.
Loss causation is the element that under the securities laws recognizes that there is no loss to investors unless there's the revelation of the truth and unless there was a proximate cause by it. Dura recognizes that in the case where somebody wasn't telling the truth, unless the truth comes out, then the price that the plaintiff paid for it, it includes the inflation. They're not hurt by it. And so if the information doesn't come out, then they have not been proximately damaged. They have not suffered cognizable economic harm. And it's not just a question of harm. The harm has to be proximately caused to the alleged misstatement. I want to add a couple more comments on their theory. Their own plaintiff, the plaintiff's own expert said, what the market does not know, it cannot react to. So the market's really been taken out of this whole equation. It's whether or not lawyers can stand up later on and say, this is rotten, this is bad. And in fact, if you apply their theory and accept it, then they can choose what negative news they want to say was the revelation of the truth. So it allows them to pick and choose, not the market to react to the truth and learn that what was covered up before has now come out. That's now out of the equation under their theory. Let's take their theory and apply it to this case. In 2001, Flowserve lowered earnings projections. If you accept their theory, that was negative news. It went to the financial condition of the company. Their theory is that earnings announcements are related to just about anything. Did they sue on that? No. But under their theory, the information came out in 2001. They waited and sued on earnings releases that came out in 2002. No mystery about it. There was a stock drop then. But if their theory is right, that information hit the marketplace a full year earlier.
Well, that would just be a statute of limitations question, wouldn't it?
It would be a question of whether.
I don't see how that helps you.
Your Honor, it helps us in this sense. If their concept is correct, that the market learned the truth when the market learns negative information that fits these two tests. Number one, it's something that goes to the financial condition of the company. And number two, in the case of earnings, it relates to what they say was the falsehood.
But your theory rewards concealment.
Our theory?
I mean, it's hard to find the right answer here because I think your theory gets people into a lot of trouble. So I don't know what the right route is.
Your Honor, in effect, their theory is defendants concealed when they first misstated. And so later on, we're going to pick a time. They're still concealing. You heard it said. They're still lying. But we're going to say that's when the market learned the truth. The market learned the truth as to the false financial statements in this case. That information came out in 2004. So this was not a question that the information didn't come out. Some of the other didn't come out because there's no evidence that it was ever false. But when the When the financial statements were restated in 2004, the market did not react. In this fraud on the market case, the market didn't react. And the whole notion of the concept is that the market efficiently processes information and it determines whether or not it cares or not about information. So that's a fundamental flaw in what they've got. In Dura, the Supreme Court said that we are not going to create a partial downside insurance policy for investors. Loss causation as an element is there because only those shareholders who actually had economic harm because of the falsehood, not because of the cover-up. If the cover-up continues then, Dura says, that inflation is still in the marketplace. This court's decisions in Greenberg, in Oscar, most recently in Cyberonix, adopts the rule that the district court used here. And that rule was the market, it is the market that must learn of the falsity. Now, you heard an argument that the district court improperly required revelation of a fraud. You could have a revelation of a fraud, and that would meet the loss causation requirement, but it's revelation of the falsity that loss causation measures. The district court didn't require fraud. If I can, I'd like to turn to the record evidence that she looked at, because the district court used a very thorough and thoughtful process as she went through the record. What she did was measure the evidence against the plaintiff's allegations. And she showed it showed to her, as her orders reflect, a number of different things. It showed that in 2002, the July and September press releases themselves didn't suggest anything about prior alleged false statements. To the contrary, those press releases repeated the same historical financials, said that the company was in compliance with its debt covenants, and made positive statements about integrations of the companies that Flowserve had acquired. The analyst reports are to the same effect. They continue to use the financials in the modeling. The stock price reflected those assumptions. The plaintiff's own investment manager said that he believed that the financial statements were correct. This was not a revelation of the truth as to that, that he continued to believe that the debt covenants were in compliance, not a revelation as to that. So what the market actually learned, as the district court found by looking at projections, was what was the new information. And there the new information was that there had been changed economic circumstances that Flowserve was experiencing. The company made its earnings announcement, the projection revision. It explained what the reasons were. It talked to analysts about it. The analysts listened. They accepted it. They found it was corroborated. This was a downturn in the chemical and the general industrial markets that was ongoing at the time and that was worse than had been anticipated. That's the kind of information that companies give to the market generally to explain developments that have happened to their business. And that was accepted. It was truthful. It is in the record. It is the reason for the downturn. The downward revision of guidance. What do the plaintiffs have in the record? Well, in some measure, it's sort of like ships passing in the night, and the reason is this. It goes to their true financial condition theory, so it really just takes out the market revelation. And there were three areas that they talked about. One was their expert. This is the same expert who said the market does not react to what it does not know, who acknowledged that there had not been a revelation of falsity as to those prior misstatements, alleged misstatements. They also talked about internal documents, documents, again, that the market never saw. And then the third thing was this relatedness test they've got. And that is that they have testimony that suggests that there is a relationship to earnings with historical financials and other things. The unremarkable proposition that anyone would say. It does not go to the issues that the district court was looking for, that Dura suggests, Oscar says, Greenberg says that it is the market that's the touchstone. It is the market must learn that there was a prior alleged misstatement. If you don't have that there, then you write out the requirement that on the front end it was the falsehood that supposedly was made to the back end, which is the market reacts not to the negative news, but to the negative news as it reveals that there was a falsehood. If the panel has any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Well, Mr. Fetkoff says the trial court's approach, in effect, gives a windfall. I mean, he may be exaggerating even the way he said it, but I have a feeling he said it that way for a reason.
They would like to argue that there is a windfall in this notion of this cover-up. But again, if you look to what the element of loss causation is, it is not to give investors an insurance policy about stock losses. The loss in stock must be proven to be the result of a misrepresentation, and that's the fatal flaw in the argument.
Thank you, Ms. Hensley.
Thank you.
Mr. Wilder.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Byron Wilder, and I represent PricewaterhouseCoopers in this action. First, I agree with pretty much everything Ms. Hensley said. I'd just like to add a couple of points. Even if plaintiffs were correct that Flowserve's 2002 disclosures somehow revealed to the market that the company's prior financial statements were false, PricewaterhouseCoopers and the underwriters in this case, who were sued only under Section 11, would still win on loss on statute of limitations grounds. Plaintiffs simply can't have it both ways. The statute of limitations under Section 11 is 1 year. It begins to run when a plaintiff is put on inquiry notice. So if those press releases somehow put the market on notice that prior financial statements were false, then they had until July 2003 to sue under Section 11. But they didn't sue PwC or the underwriters until May of 2004, 21 months after they claimed the market learned the truth. I'd also like to point out, particularly since there was so much commentary about fraud and things rotten in Scandinavian countries, that PwC was sued solely under Section 11 and not for any fraud. So PwC can be liable in this case only if there were misstatements in the 2000 and 2001 audited financial statements of Flowserve. But plaintiff's own expert and plaintiffs themselves have acknowledged that the press releases didn't say that. Thus, the market reaction that followed those press releases is not related to any misstatement in the prior financials. Greenberg versus Crossroads is directly on point because there, one of the disclosures that drove down the stock price was that the third quarter of 2000 was going to be lower than the market had expected. The court found that that disclosure was unrelated to alleged prior misstatements regarding the first and second quarters of 2000. The only difference here is that the disconnect between my client's alleged misstatements regarding 2000 and 2001 are even more unrelated to the disclosure of projected results in late 2002. Thank you, Your Honors. Do you have any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Wilder. We got your remarks. Okay, Mr. Spetkov, you have 3 minutes of rebuttal.
It's absolutely correct that when the financials were restated in 2004, the market didn't react. The stock price didn't change. That tells you a lot about what's significant to the market in 2002. In 2002, when the company reduced its earnings by 29% over a two-month period, the stock price went down 37%, 38%, 60% in total. The market, for loss purposes, Judge Wiener, it's sufficient that the market understood there was something economically wrong with Flowserve. For proving the ultimate fraud in court, to prove it in your terms, rotten, the plaintiffs have to prove the falsity and scienter the difficult elements, falsity when made and scienter. That proves the rottenness. What the market understands is that there's something wrong. The market are not prosecutors. They're not lawyers. They know, what they did know was this. They've been told for years that the company was doing well, that things were turning around, and that 2002 in particular was going to be a great year, 40 to 50% better than 2001. And by the way, that July 24th, 2001 downtick had nothing to do with the 2002 forecasts. It had to do with the 2001 forecasts, which are not the subject of this part of the lawsuit. So that's a red herring. And plus, the stock price went down 10% but bounced right back up. So there was no loss. You can't fault us for not over-pleading a case. We picked on the most serious events. And so the market understood there was something wrong and reacted to that. And to say that the market has to have a revelation of the falsity of the debt compliance and the falsity of the historical results at the very same time of the corrective disclosure runs right into the fact that they issued a second press release on September 27th saying falsely that they were in compliance and that they had, and republishing their historical results, which they had to restate 2 years later, and knew were false because of all the internal evidence that's in the record that the judge refused to consider. So if you're, Justice O'Connor, you're looking for balance. Well, balance cannot excuse continuing to lie, because that's what happened here. They just put off telling the truth or having the truth revealed until they were forced to restate when finally the auditors just couldn't go on any longer with this chaos. And it was chaos. Their accounting was in shambles. $60 million restated over two restatements. So let me go back to first for loss. I am out of time. I think you've got it.
We have your argument.
Thank you. Yeah.
Court will take about a 10-minute recess.